welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. This week, we're asking two shipping companies, Ardmore and Stenable, how they have navigated the first year of the Fuel EU Maritime Regulation, which requires ships to bring down the greenhouse gas intensity of the energy they use, starting with a 2% reduction. The regulation has introduced new layers of complexity for the industry, not least the concept of pooling, which allows ships that overperform to transfer their compliance surpluses to other undercompliant ships. Fuel EU Maritime also has teeth, with penalties of €2,400 per tonne of VLSFO energy equivalent for ships that fail to comply with the GHG intensity limit. So how did the first year go in practice, both in companies' boardrooms and on vessels' bridges? We'll first get the views of Robert Gaynor, Chief Operating Officer at Ardmore, a company based in Ireland that owns and operates 25 chemical and product tankers. Welcome to the podcast, Robert.
Hi, Ariane. Thanks for having me.
So how did you choose your compliance approach for Fuel EU Maritime? And how did that approach evolve or maybe change during that first year?
Yeah, very good question. And thank you, Ariane. Well, the first year, definitely it was challenging, but also very clarifying. Fuel EU Maritime made it clear that decarbonization is no longer theoretical and it is operational, commercial, and happening voyage by voyage. For us, the first year wasn't about finding a perfect solution immediately. It was about building a compliance approach that is flexible, robust, and commercially realistic in a very uncertain environment. What Fuel EU really forced us to do was to think differently, not just about fuel choices, but about behaviors, decision-making, and essentially alignment across the organization.
And so in practical terms, what approach did you go for? Did you go for pooling? Did you bunker some biofuels or other fuels on your fleet?
From the outset, we deliberately avoided locking ourselves into a single rigid compliance pathway. Fuel availability, pricing, market exposure, and of course the charter structures were and still are evolving. So back to your question, our decision was to comply with the regulation by purchasing biofuel on very, very specific voyages.
What were the practical, very tangible changes for your teams, if we think maybe first on board and then ashore and in the decision-making boards?
Yeah, very good question. I would say that the biggest change wasn't technical. It was behavioral. Clearly, onboard crews had to understand that speed, routing, and fuel decision now have regulatory consequences, not just fuel cost implications. On the other hand, ashore, Fuel EU really broke down silos. Chartering operation, technical operation and commercial operation teams had to work much more closely because you can no longer optimize one function in isolation. So I think for me, the biggest change, it was the behavioral change. Now we had practical experience with biofuel, so the industry shared a lot of documentation in this space. So once again, the change wasn't technical. It was behavioral, how you approach the voyage planning, how you approach your bunker procurement, how you work with these partners and how you work within your own organization.
And in terms of the administrative burden also and operational changes, how does compliance with Fuel EU Maritime compare with EU ETS, which entered into force exactly a year prior?
Yeah, I think there are different layers here. So mainly we are a spot operator, and when we fix spot voyages on a world scale basis, EU ETS is now increasingly embedded in the commercial equation. It is a known and visible variable that can be priced and accounted for at the fixture stage. So I wouldn't say that there is an administrative burden in this space. PLU is different. It's not explicitly embedded in WorldScale, for that matter. And compliance is measured annually and at the fleet level. So it becomes an owner optimization challenge rather than a contractual line item. So in this context, the administrative burden, there is an element of that because you need a designated team to monitor essentially all these parameters since fuel is measured at the fleet level. We have, as you probably know, we have a joint venture with Anglo Armor, our technical managers, and they are the one in charge of this element of the fuel. So it's more data compliance and data gathering, which is not, from our perspective, that difficult because we started probably more than a decade ago to install high-frequency data sensor on board our ships to give us a clear understanding of our consumption. So the data was there for long ago, and data quality is good. Indeed, from the overhead perspective, you need to assign a specific function for this compliance element.
That's an interesting point, actually, because one of the key differences between EU ETS and fuel EU maritime is that, you know, with EU ETS, it's about purchasing those allowances. At any given time, there's going to be a price on the market for those. However, with fuel EU maritime, one of the challenges is to establish the price for compliance in all of those contracts. So what has been your approach to that?
Yeah, as you said, it is a clear difference between the two. I think for us it was important to understand exactly what is our exposure, and as I said earlier on, we are primarily a spot operator, so therefore our visibility down the line where we are going to perform the voyages, it's quite limited because more often than not, that's a decision that the charterer will take. Non-compliance ultimately manifests as a penalty rather than a recoverable voyage cost. So from the governance perspective, we were very clear that paying a fuel EU penalty is not acceptable compliance strategy for us. So beyond the financial aspect, it also sends the wrong signals to regulators, charterers, and other stakeholders. So definitely our objective is to remain compliant through proactive operational and commercial optimization and not to treat penalties as a cost of doing business.
And so for those biofuels purchases, was that something that Ardmore had to foot the bill off, or was there any element of cost sharing?
Yeah, the cost sharing element is not yet in the picture. It's a voyage cost that it's passed through a some point, but mostly it's an owner decision for the spot market.
And you raise a really interesting point because, as you said, your vessels are mostly operated on the spot market, but you also have a few on time charters. How would you compare the complexity of ensuring compliance in both cases?
Yeah, I think there is a complexity around spot market because, as mentioned earlier, you don't have much visibility and then you need to be careful from and to optimize that. On the chartering side, it's a contractual agreement that allows us to, let's say, compare notes on a quarterly basis. And the compliance with regulation has been agreed when we actually signed the charter party. So I would say that it's easier. It's an easier approach when you have a time charter agreement because everything is kind of like set in stone through contractual terms.
And now, how did the regulation affect your company in commercial terms? Because there were fears that it would make European companies less competitive. So did those concerns materialize?
I will not share the let's say, the same concerns. It is a concern indeed. It is a cost, as we said earlier on. But at the end of the day, the market evolves and probably down the line, this will be a pass-through cost. similarly to what we have seen in EU ETS. At the end of the day, this is a decarbonization strategy, and the regulation made it very clear that it's no longer a question about how much you burn. With fuel EU is about what you burn. And in that context, I would not agree that this makes the European companies less competitive.
And what were the main lessons from that first year of fuel EU Maritime? What will you be doing differently, perhaps, going forward?
I would say that flexibility beats optimization in an uncertain environment. Second, data quality matters more than probably sophisticated models. And third, organizational alignment is absolutely critical. Fuel EU cannot be managed in silos. So this would be the key lessons for us. And in terms of strategy moving forward, it essentially is not to bet on a single fuel or a single pathway. It's to remain adaptable and continue investing in efficiency and strengthen decision making and data discipline. And of course, stay commercially grounded as the regulatory landscape evolves. Fuel EU is not 1 year exercise. As I said earlier on, we are a spot operator. So therefore, this is not a 1 year exercise. It's a structural change in how shipping operates, and we are positioning ourselves accordingly.
You talked just now about the importance of organizational alignment. What does that mean in practice?
In very simple terms, the conversation around fuel EU is no longer a decision that is taken by commercial department or commercial operation or technical department in silos. It needs to be a conversation. What we are going to burn, what type of fuel, where is the most economic location for us to purchase that bunker, and ultimately to ensure that by buying that bunker, we complete the voyage in Europe, and therefore we will offset the penalties. So this is the reality of the fuel. Has reinforced something that we already believe, that good governance, good operation, and good commercial discipline are essentially inseparable.
And to finish, the GHG intensity reductions that are required by Fuel EU Maritime will gradually increase. So there was 2% initially, that's going to go up to 6% in 2030, 31% in 2040, 80% in 50. So what is your long-term strategy? Are investments in new fuels on the cards, for example?
I would say that, again, we're not going to bet on one pathway. Our strategy is to remain flexible and to be mindful that the technology evolves as we know. And once we have conviction on the new technology, that we'll have to adopt that new technology, whether that's going to be, let's say, methanol engine or different type of engines. So our long-term strategy is to be flexible and to allow us to be flexible, but certainly compliance is not something that is negotiable, and we will comply.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.
For another perspective, I'm pleased to welcome Philip First, Sustainability Manager at Stena Bulk, a tanker shipping company headquartered in Sweden, which operates 58 vessels. Thanks for joining us, Philip.
Thank you very much for having me.
So when it comes to Fuel EU compliance, Stena Bulk has perhaps more options than other companies, if I can put it like that, having six vessels that are capable of using methanol as fuel in your fleet. So what approach did you go for? Was it mostly based on using methanol, or did you instead focus on biofuels or pooling?
It's a little bit of a mixed bag, you can say. When we started looking at it, we quite early decided that we'll explore the alternative fuels approach, but to mainly also look into pooling our fleet, I would say. Mainly because, of course, the price of alternative fuels is still quite a little bit up in the air. For Fuel EU as well, there's certain fuels that we can see are more effective when it comes to generating surplus. And thus, we decided that we'll have to take a bit of more of a pragmatic approach and look at what's best for us right now and the fleet that we have year to year, on a year to year basis, I would say.
Now, you said you explored pooling options. Was that mostly as a compliance supplier or as a compliance buyer?
As a buyer, I would say. One of the main challenges that we have, right, is that we trade most of our vessels on the spot market. And that means that we do not necessarily always know when we will call Europe or be, you know, involved in Fuel EU voyages, so to say, or ETS for that matter, right? And that's really been one of the bigger challenges this year when you have a voyage that maybe intends to go to the EU, but then it turns out not going to the EU. And that's been one of the main risks that we saw with dedicating ourselves into an alternative fuel, like let's say methanol or biofuel. Because if you were to bunker and consume the alternative fuel, and then the voyage does not go to Europe, then, you know, it's still, of course, a good decarbonization voyage. But from a Fuel EU perspective, it's not really taken into account, which is why from a spot market perspective, we have a bit of an issue with that, while maybe the liner companies or people trading strictly within the EU have a little bit of an easier time strategizing around it.
And so if you look at the full picture for the year, how much of your compliance was achieved through using alternative fuels and how much was achieved through pooling?
Still doing the final verifications, of course, but roughly 15% was alternative fuels.
And now I'd like to hear your thoughts about the admin and the complexities or non-complexities of being part of such pools, because there were quite a bit of concerns from some people in the industry. So how did that go for you?
I mean, to be honest, we're still right in the middle of it, right? It's pooling doesn't take place until March, April. So the honest answer is we don't know yet. But of course, as you say, there's been a lot of discussions around how to pool, with whom to pool, when to pool. It ended up in an interesting place from a contractual perspective, because I think the industry I'm talking about, you know, my specific niche in this, right, we've developed quite quickly over the year. In the beginning of the year, really, we saw quite a bit of, you know, let's just wait and see what happens. People did not really grasp the legislation or the regulation yet. Somewhere around, I would say, summertime, you could see things kicking into gear. And maybe it had something to do with the, you know, the first surrendering period for ETS allowances. You know, that this is actually quite a bit of money that's involved. And here's the next step of it. And also, of course, the end of the year rapidly approaching. And hence, you could see that people were more willing to discuss clauses with you and look at pooling options. So I think the industry has made quite a bit of a journey in just this year. But again, we're not finished with the first year yet. So it'd be interesting to see how it all comes to fruition.
One of the challenges with Fuel EU Maritime is that the emissions reductions mandated by the regulation actually have to be completed or achieved during that calendar year. So what was your approach to, you know, transparency and data sharing to make sure that the pool as a whole would be compliant and that you would avoid any penalties come this time when you have to do the maths and all that.
It's a really good point, right? The fact that this is a regulation framework that runs on a calendar year basis doesn't at all line up with how, you know, commercial contracts works, right? So that's been a main issue to deal with for us. How do we do when we have a vessel maybe that we've taken in for a couple of months? Can we still pool that vessel? And that's a discussion you have with each and every owner for us as an operator, and vice versa, of course, if we charter out a vessel towards a charterer. Are we going to pool? Are the charterers going to pool? And key, as you mentioned there, the key part for us, of course, has been that if we are going to pool a vessel on behalf of someone else, we need full transparency when it comes to the data. And it's been challenging for many different reasons. But it's also, I would say, I mean, we as an industry, we've been discussing, you know, and talking about data and transparency and digitalization for many, many years now. I think Fuelio has actually managed to push that agenda quite a bit in, you know, this small niche in there, because when you have the conversation with an owner and you have, you know, all the parties realize that, okay, if we're gonna spend, to be frank, as little money as possible or be as efficient as possible in living up to this regulation, then it's absolutely necessary for us to freely share information between each other for this purpose. And that's been very fun, I would say. Very freeing to see that we've actually taken a lot of steps in that regard just during the year. So it's very positive in that remark.
And how did you actually solve that challenge of agreeing on that responsibility for compliance and, quite importantly, the price of compliance with your customers? Yeah, how did you do it? How did you reflect that in contractual agreements?
I mean, when it comes to price, of course, you have to look into what's possible and what's the market price. A main thing I would say is, and this goes a little bit back to the BIMCO clause that came out for a few leading charter parties, right, is that sometimes or often, as in the clause, you actually pay the owner at set intervals. And then at the end, when you actually do the pooling, you can recoup that cost because the cost lies with us as the operator charter. But an interesting thing about the data collection, of course, is that everyone is using different, you know, collection systems, different ways of visualizing the data, different standards. And that's been something that we've been working with quite a lot this year. Everyone has, you know, a different perspective input when it comes to the data, and trying to find a common ground, a common standard that we can align on has been quite a bit of work.
I'd like to go back to a point you mentioned earlier about the fact that about 15% of your compliance throughout the year was achieved through bunkering alternative fuels. I was curious as if, has FuelEU Maritime changed your approach to fuel procurement, and has it changed the volumes of methanol or biofuels that you've been using on the fleet compared to previous years?
To a certain extent, yes, I think. Mainly because, in the end, we're in the tank industry. We're still in a market where there is no commercial drive to burn alternative fuels necessarily. But FuelEU and the ETS in this case, actually, I mean, that it doesn't bridge the gap always completely, but it narrows it. And of course, there's a certain like price gap where we as an operator owner can go in and say, okay, this is actually worth decarbonizing or going for the more expensive low carbon fuel. So yeah, I would say that we look at it a little bit different now. It's more of a conscious decision making.
And if we look at the bigger picture, at the end of the day, FuelEU Maritime was built around the objective of incentivizing a switch to lower carbon fuels. Is it fit for purpose? And does it work in practice for shipping companies?
I think it's maybe a little bit too early to tell with confidence, but I do see potential in being able to actually commercialize your decarbonization, essentially, especially if you're looking to generate surplus and sell on in a pooling solutions. And we can see that being done in some cases, right? And that's going to be really interesting to follow. And also, you know, maybe take part of, depending on a lot of things, of course. I think a common viewpoint, right, is that the problem is that it's a regional regulation, both fuel EU and the EU ETS. And that, again, as mentioned, makes it more difficult to follow as a spot market operator. And of course, we would prefer some kind of global, all-encompassing regulation.
If we look ahead, we know that the fuel EU targets will become more stringent. You've mentioned just now that there could be commercial opportunities or opportunities to make revenues from selling compliance surpluses. So I was curious about your long-term vision and your long-term strategy. Is Sustainable going to consider becoming a surplus generator, for example?
As long as it's a regional regulation, I think that will be quite difficult for us just due to the nature of our business. I think that is something more favorable for liner companies, etc. We, of course, have, you know, our sister company is a ferry company trading in a lot in Europe. And so it's a really interesting opportunity for them, I would say, for example, or other like companies like that. But I think from a spot market operator, building partnerships, long-lasting partnerships with surplus generators is key. Because as you say, once the needed fuel is going to increase, then having those partnerships is going to be very, very important in order to not risk paying the penalty instead of, well, pooling in this case.
And what would you say was the number one challenge from that first year of Fuel EU Maritime, and what learnings are you going to implement going forward?
I think it comes down to the contracts. Everyone in the industry is learning as we go, and there's a lot of different, very specific clauses right now, and hopefully we can see some alignment on clauses coming forward once we know best practice.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Thank you so much for having me.